I believe companies have been awakened. And prior to the last year and a half, people have certainly been on a spectrum, everywhere from I'm down with the cause, I get it, to I don't understand it and we don't need it because, you know, the numbers are speaking for themselves, that kind of thing. I think when you take COVID and what that meant in terms of things being turned upside down, you know, teams being remote at best, maybe hybrid, if you will, and what does it mean to meet each person where they are? So the urgency around that, they couldn't drag their feet. But then you couldn't turn around and say, I can move mountains for COVID. But when it comes to equality and equitably investing, you know, let's slow down. You couldn't do that. And so I think for many, and I'd say the vast majority, they realize, okay, there really is a problem. It's hard to know if it's not your reality or you don't have, let's just say, a more diverse circle, or you're surrounded at the higher ranks with everyone that's maybe more homogeneous to really understand what is going on.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Lisa Skeet Tatum is the founder of Landit, a career pathing platform created to increase the success of women and diverse groups in the workplace. The platform offers a turnkey, one-size-fits-one solution that enables companies to attract, develop, and retain diverse talent. To say Lisa is busy is an understatement. She serves on numerous high-growth public and nonprofit boards, including New York Stock Exchange Stryker Corporation and USHG Acquisition Corp. Also, Union Square Hospitality Group, Cornell University Board of Trustees, the MacArthur Theater, the Lawrenceville School, and the Harvard Business School Board of Dean's Advisors. Lisa has also been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Fast Company, Vanity Fair, Fortune, Inc., Black Enterprise, and CNBC. And she is named one of the most impressive women entrepreneurs by Inc. Landit was even named one of the top 10 innovations that made women's lives better by Fast Company. You could definitely say Lisa has made quite a name for herself. My conversation with Lisa Skeet Tatum is coming up after the break. The following message comes from Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, a global edge-to-cloud company helping you prepare for the next wave of digital transformation. If you're looking to add a podcast to your mix, tune into HPE Tech Talk. It's a podcast for business leaders and change makers that want to be in the know on the latest tech trends that are propelling businesses and whole industries forward. The HPE Tech Talk podcast tackles big tech predictions and explores questions like, how can you monetize data? What's the future of cloud? And why is zero trust the gold standard for security? Search HPE Tech Talk in your podcast app to subscribe.
And now, on with the show.
We are back. So with so much success and experience across so many different areas, I wanted to begin our conversation by asking Lisa about her varied career and how it led her to eventually start Landit.
First, I'm super glad to be speaking with you. I can't believe how long it's been, but that means today's a lucky day.
It is.
And I like your choice of the word varied because it's definitely taking lots of turns. So I won't take you as far back as birth, but we'll at least go back to the beginning of my career. So I'm a chemical engineer by training, which means my two teenage boys who are 19 and 17 think I know something about math and science. And I started working at Procter & Gamble in engineering and product development and quickly realized that I was more of a business person. So was able to convince them to let me go over to product supply. And I was there working on everything from Pantene to Citrus Hill orange juice to their cosmetic industry. And so when they started acquiring those businesses, so even though I wasn't in an entrepreneurial venture, I was entrepreneurial. And so as they started acquiring businesses, I raised my hand. And then I got recruited away to join a startup in the health and beauty area. And after about a year of launching 634 products, not that I was counting.
634. Okay, that's a small amount. And yeah, you definitely remember.
Because I felt every last one of those SKUs. And then at the end of that, I was like, well, gosh, how do I do this for more people? And someone said, what about venture capital? I'm like, well, what is that? I know nothing about it, but that sounds like what I want to do. And they said, well, you don't have any network. So your only chance of getting in is to go back to where they meant lots of VCs. So I applied to business school and fortunately I got in. So I went back to do VC and that was my end all be all. And after about a decade, I realized I didn't want to do that anymore. And then things got sticky because I didn't know what I wanted to do. Everyone expected me to know. It felt really uncomfortable because no one walks around saying, hey, I don't know what to do next, or I don't have it charted, because there's a social cost to doing so. So we suffer in silence. And about that time, I was accepted as a Henry Crown Fellow at the Aspen Institute. You have to have a project you think is going to change the world. And I realized my project was me, that there were millions of people just trying to figure out how do they achieve success on their own terms, but not knowing where to start and not knowing what they didn't know and not having the access. So I actually founded Landed, not because I set out to be an entrepreneur, but because there was a pain point for myself. But when I looked at the millions of people and all the talent sitting on the sidelines, I couldn't live with the status quo.
Yeah.
So I started Landed there.
I could imagine that. And it's such an interesting story about how you got to that point. But I want to go back. You said that after 10 years of doing VC, you kind of didn't want to do it anymore. What was the reason?
So it certainly is one of the best experiences of my life. But I realized that the system is somewhat broken, that the people who were receiving the capital, and this persists to this day, is not equitable, that sometimes the partners and the funders are not necessarily aligned. And what I loved about what I did is I got to work with amazing entrepreneurs in healthcare who were also changing the world in access, but it wasn't quite enough. But I wouldn't change it for the world, because I'm not sure I could have started Landed without that experience, not to mention being able to fund some of the best companies in the world today in healthcare and healthcare technology specifically. So yeah, but it was a really scary moment because, you know, when you're so used to doing and you're on a path and you're getting stuff done, all of a sudden it's like, whoops, now what, right? And where do you go after you've been a general partner? It's not like, you know, there's 50 million things, because many times, again, we don't even know what we don't know.
How hard was that for you, walking away and then jumping into this business that's really yours? Because I would imagine at that point, you've been super successful, you've funded tons of businesses, worked with other businesses, saw successes, and now you were putting yourself basically out there. What was that feeling like?
Oh, let's see, frightening. And exhilarating at the same time. And we talk a lot, and I personally talk a lot about taking risk, because as we progress in our career, we tend to be risk averse at a time when we have to put ourselves out there. And I would say I was a reluctant entrepreneur. And that's why when people say, you know, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, I'm not so sure I trust that, because it is so hard that if you don't have a core mission that you're willing to run through fire for, you're probably going to have a pretty rough go at it, because it is far from glamorous, but it is, you're going to stick to it, you're going to pull, and you're going to do whatever you can to make it happen. So for me, it was quite scary and unsettling, because I was used to being on a path. And of course, you ask yourself things like, well, what happens if it fails? And I would say the deck certainly wasn't stacked in my favor. Trying to redefine a category, trying to raise capital, building a business from scratch. I mean, all of the things that we know, I would say there was quite a bit of risk there. But the vision, I never wavered, right? The true north of what I set out to do, which is democratize career success and access. And I realized, if not me, then who, right? That I could pull in all that experience. So from that perspective, it was great because I had the raw ingredients. But as most entrepreneurs, many times at 3 a.m, you're like, what the blank did I do? What did I get myself into?
I know that feeling very well.
So, but no, it was definitely challenging. And what I tell people is, when you're at these inflection points, that's when you have to reach out to others. You can't iterate in a vacuum. Because sometimes you just need to whiteboard it out. You need to surround yourself with people who are going to give you that gentle, loving push when you're maybe second guessing so that you can move forward with intention.
How did you get that second push? Was there a second push for you to start Landit when you left?
So what's interesting, when I left, I thought I was going to do something in the impact investing space. I was looking at all the things that were adjacent to what I had done before that married my passion with my experience with, as you can tell, I'm very mission driven. And so that's where I was focused. But as I was working on my project at Aspen Institute, I remember the head saying, you know, Lisa, that's great and all, but push yourself a little bit more. And I remember my husband saying, that's great, but you should be running your own thing. And then as I started kind of whiteboarding it out and talking with others and my co-founder, who also happened to be a great friend, I was like, you know, no, this is it. I don't know what the it looks like. I know what the mission is, but I like to say I win first because you can rationalize yourself out of anything. Sometimes you got to say, this is what I'm doing. And then you back up from there, as opposed to always being logical, because whenever you do that, you cap potential. And I'm an engineer saying not to be logical. So you know that's something, right?
Yeah, I see you've become a full entrepreneur and your engineering days might be behind you. But yeah, it's funny, as an entrepreneur myself, it's always just jump off the diving board, figure it out later, understand what you're going after, and it will come to you. But you know, there's a lot of ups and downs in that. And I'm curious, when you started the business, do you remember some of those real initial challenges? And was there ever a time you thought, wow, maybe I should have just stayed and done the VC thing?
Let's just say I definitely had a cushier life prior to doing this. And of course, I had young children at the time. So it wasn't just that and the boards I was serving on, but what was the impact on my family and things of that sort? So I didn't jump into it lightly. And yes, it was hard, because if someone said to me early on, what we do is non-trivial, because there are companies that just do one slice of the different components. But I knew from the very beginning that we had to take a different approach, that we had to turn how career access and development is done on its head. And so when you're trying to redefine a way of being, there's a lot of enrolling and storytelling and iteration that happens. And it had a level of complexity, but it had to look simple. And so a lot of the challenges were around the product itself. What I did learn as a VC is that you can't be a nice to have. That's your fastest way to running out of money and failure. So really understanding what were we solving for, and not just the form, but also the content itself. But I understood the persona because I was a persona. So that part was easy. Now it's like, well, how do you build something with ease and all those things? So I'd say those moments when I was like, oh my goodness, was certainly around product, was around go-to-market, right? Because we definitely have a consumer product, but focused on an enterprise-type sell. So how do we do that? And then fundraising, oh my goodness, no wonder my entrepreneurs love me. Because that process, I wouldn't wish on anyone. And the thing is, I have now great funders, and I came from that industry, and it was still challenging.
Wow.
And so just going through that process, I'm like, now what the heck?
What did you learn from that process? It's funny, because it's, you're someone who had 10 years on the other side, and then you went from it on the other side. And what was it that you learned, and what were the challenges? Because it sounds like when you speak about it, that was really one of the harder things.
Definitely. I would say some of the lessons that I used to share, I actually brought into it. So choosing your partners wisely. And many times, because fundraising is so hard, you just take people, not me, take the money where they can get it. But I have seen what happens when you don't partner with people who are aligned, that if something goes sideways, they have more flight than fight, that kind of thing. So I made sure to do my diligence. I made sure to think, because it is so hard to get that money, who's going to stick around for the next round, that type of thing. So that was really important. But I also knew the importance of getting the right partners at the beginning, because you never get another chance to kind of accelerate in that regard. But it was tough. It was really, really tough. And certainly I knew how to pitch, and I knew how to storytell and have a business model that you can actually trace the dollars, all those things I knew as a VC. And it was still hard.
Yeah,
it was still hard. But at the end of the day, they're betting on you. And I knew that, right? When you don't have a product, because I didn't, I barely had a business plan. They're betting on you.
Yeah.
And so what I had that maybe others didn't have is that I had folks who had believed in me because we had worked together. But
it sounds tiring and difficult. And I have heard that at the end of the day, most VCs, and especially for our listeners, they're looking at the person and of course the idea and the big opportunity. But at the end of the day, they know things might shift, things might change. It comes down to the individual. And you just said that. Do you believe in that wholeheartedly?
I do at the early stage, because as you said, things are going to pivot and change, et cetera. So you have to believe in the person that you're backing. Now, that doesn't mean that's to the exclusion of everything else. It's got to be a big market. How are you building a moat? You got to just believe that they're going to win.
Yeah. Right?
That's a big enough opportunity that they're going to win. And I think that's where some of the unconscious and conscious biases enter when you're looking at funding, you know, women or diverse groups, et cetera, because, and I've seen it, where the rubric can shift.
Now, tell us about Landit. You know, if you were to talk about it as explaining it to a friend, so our listeners can really get a feel for this incredible business. And as you know, me and you have talked over the years, and I've loved the business you're in. I just think, like you said, it's mission-driven. It's so right, especially you started it even before a lot of the movements we've had. But if you were to tell an individual about the business, how would you explain it?
So now you're making me very happy to talk about what I learned.
Yeah, we got the tough stuff out of the way. I mean, semi-tough stuff, but we got your VC out of the way. We got that hard. But tell me about this, because I know from you, like, this is your mission and it's about doing well. And I always admire, there's levels I look of entrepreneurs. There's the entrepreneurs like myself who start something in a field they love, like sports and entertainment or podcasting. Mm-hmm. There's entrepreneurs who just start anything because they need to make money or whatever it might be. And then there's these entrepreneurs who are on a mission. And like we had Ethan Brown on the show who, you know, started Beyond Meat. And that was a mission, right?
Yes.
That's what I love about what you're doing. So talk to me about Landit.
Yes. So we are committed and focused on helping everyone achieve success on their own terms. So we take everything that would typically be reserved for the top of the pyramid, and most of us don't make it to the top of the pyramid, and kind of this one size fits one, where each and every person can own and drive their career because that's what's required these days. But we are there to support with all the key elements: access to a certified coach, developing your board of advisors, how to strengthen your personal brand. Because we know where you are and where you're heading, we can recommend what are the skills and the content and the access to information that you need to drive yourself forward in this very personalized way, meeting each person where they are. But it's portable because no one stays in the same position for the entirety of their career. The other piece that we realize is that it's trusted. So if you go back to the story I told you before about when you're at these inflection points, you don't want to broadcast to 50,000 of your closest friends that you were in a place that's maybe not as secure. So when we talk to our friends, when we tell the story, it's about meeting you where you are, giving you what you need, but pathing you forward one step at a time. Because many times we think about our career and it's like, it's this big boil of the ocean, when it's really a series of micro bites. And all they have to do is give us the email. So what we say is when you arrive there, it's better than Allstate. You're in better hands than Allstate because we have you. So when you get there, you're going to get the best caliber. You're going to know what to do. You're going to have the access. And we're going to be with you every step of the way on that journey. And what's amazing is our premises, it's not about capability, it's about access. Because so many organizations focus on intake, which is important, but equally important is what happens when someone gets there. Do they stay? Do they thrive? Do they progress? So you can look at any organization, for-profit, non, small company, large, and you see this thinning out diversity as you go up the ranks, right? Everyone is kind of clustered at the bottom or the entry level, and it goes all the way up to the board level. And so I'm like, you know what? That really is about access and pathing and intentional investment. It's not about motivation. It's not about, do I have the skills or the technical chops? It's really about giving someone almost as if you were giving their own virtual career concierge. So when it's like the best feeling, when we say these things, people are like, "Whoa!" It's like, where have you been? That's all I needed to get unstuck. And so we said, well, what is it that we know is required? What is it that we learned the hard way? And what is it that we wish we had? So it's not just coaching. It's not just skill development. It's not just building your board and having a sponsor. It is the knitting together of all of those things that is the difference maker. And we see it. Engagement, retention, mobility, going from a place of feeling not secure or maybe less than confident to firing on all cylinders in an accelerated way. So that is the best part of what we do is I get to hear every day people are like, what I thought was impossible is now possible. It's like, yes, that would be me doing the happy dance. So.
Yes, which you just did for our audience who's listening. Lisa did a great happy dance, which I can only imagine like how happy that would make me to know that I've really helped someone. And I look at that as more than achieving any financial success or business success. I imagine you get a lot of emails and thank yous. And how does that make you feel at this point in your career?
It's great because as you said, I started this not because I had to, but I had to because I couldn't live with the way things are. What I tell people is that they're not mutually exclusive. You can do the right thing and it's economic and competitive imperative to doing so. And so I think that's why we've been so successful with the rolling out, not just individuals, but to our enterprise customers, because they're also lost. And as you said, this was even before COVID, before the awakening around workplace social injustice and access. And so now all the people that they've tried to get in the door, they now have a turnkey way to invest in their success, which also signals to the individual, yes, someone here cares about me, so I don't have to go somewhere else. And now I can bring the full measure of myself to the workplace where I am to not only benefit my career, but actually the company and the people that we serve. And so it's a win-win-win situation. When I was on the dark VC side in healthcare, part of the problem with healthcare is the person that pays doesn't always accrue the benefit. And so we always had to look at that. But here, when the individual wins, the organization wins, right? Communities win. Customers win. And quite frankly, people are paying attention. No longer can organizations get away with, you know, having this disparity in the workplace, not being proximate to the people they serve. So what I love is that I solve it and the team solves it for the individual, but we also solve it for the enterprise and we solve it for the greater community. So it's hard, make no mistake about that, but you can see the ROI. And when I hear these personal stories, it's like, you know, it's worth it. It is absolutely worth it.
Totally. I would love as an entrepreneur to hear those stories of how people were helped or, I mean, just personally, that's got to be just incredibly fulfilling.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
You could pick up that trendy, buzzworthy business book, or you could learn the timeless lessons of a straightforward, modern classic. From a CEO with a real-world track record of decades upon decades of actual exponential business growth. The choice, of course, is up to you. Discover Good Profit by Charles Koch, Timeless Truths, buzzword free at goodprofitbook.com.
And we're back.
I'm interested how, as I said, you started this company before all of these things have happened in such a short period of time over the last 3 or 4 years. And that's why you were so far ahead of the curve of what was happening. And I'm very curious now when you're working with enterprise companies after, you know, going through a lot of the social justice stuff, the Me Too movement, COVID, how have companies changed? Have they really changed? Are they looking for real help within this area? Or is this something that unfortunately might not last? What's your thoughts?
So I believe companies have been awakened. And prior to the last year and a half, people have certainly been on a spectrum everywhere from I'm down with the cause, I get it, to I don't understand it and we don't need it because, you know, the numbers are speaking for themselves, that kind of thing. I think when you take COVID and what that meant in terms of things being turned upside down, you know, teams being remote at best, maybe hybrid, if you will, and what does it mean to meet each person where they are? So the urgency around that, they couldn't drag their feet. But then you couldn't turn around and say, I can move mountains for COVID, but when it comes to equality and equitably investing, you know, let's slow down. You couldn't do that. And so I think for many, and I'd say the vast majority, they realize, okay, there really is a problem. It's hard to know if it's not your reality or you don't have, let's just say, a more diverse circle, or you're surrounded at the higher ranks with everyone that's maybe more homogeneous to really understand what is going on. And so the speed at which companies move, not all, but some, I think was very telling about not just what's at the top, but how do they empower throughout the organization, but also how are boards holding them accountable. Those that were slow to move, I think they felt the pain. Because not only are you signaling to diverse groups, but you're also signaling to stakeholders and allies and customers and investors. And I do think that was new for folks, and it's uncomfortable because most people don't have the skills. We know that what gets measured gets done. So when I tell people the seven things you should start and stop doing, it begins with the same urgency and metrics and accountability for this that you have for everything else. And so what's great about us being able to solve this is when we show up and say, now you can be intentional, you can actually make the investment that you need to have the outcomes, and you can measure in a way that is turnkey and seamless. So it has certainly been a journey, but I think that's why we have seen the acceleration and we're not going back. I think the bigger challenge we have now is leaders that don't get ahead of how they're going to, quote, bring people back or not in this new environment. And those that rushed to, we're going back to where we were before, they're going to be in for a very rude awakening. When you have people who are in and those who maybe for personal reasons or other reasons who cannot fully engage or don't want to, then there's going to be this whole dynamic of creating FOMO, right? What am I missing out? And it's going to have an impact on culture. So leaders have to get ahead of this. And it also goes to, again, meeting people where they are with development. So we certainly could not have foreseen the circumstances, but I am a glass half full person because I don't know any entrepreneur that's not. Otherwise, you'd curl up in a ball and you'd be done with. Yes. But it is an opportunity to unleash talent. It is an opportunity to level the playing field, to meet people where they are, wherever they may be, so that they can fully engage in a way that's fruitful for everyone. For that reason, I'm excited. But I'm also seeing the cracks in some organizations. I'm like, okay, you guys better get with it. Yeah. Or this is going to be the third wave of pain and ultimately your ability to thrive kind of post the situation we've gone through.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most incredible things that's happened through these last couple of years, just in terms of what I've seen is like people don't want to do business with companies that aren't diverse, that aren't socially impactful, that have these issues. And I assume, you know, it's coming from a lot of different generations. And if you don't get on board, it's going to be, you're going to, like you said, feel that pain. And I imagine that with you and working with these different companies, that I look at it now, obviously at the top in these boardrooms, a lot of guys, it's very white, like, but I think, and do you agree with what you're doing on helping on all these levels? It seems like you're grooming a lot of people to move into these positions, to help them to navigate the playing field. Is that one of the big goals where you think there'll really be change at the end of the day, is getting more minorities, women into the board or into boardrooms?
Absolutely. I think it comes from both directions. I mean, ultimately, the head of the organization is the head of DEI. It's not this kind of discrete position kind of off on the side. They're partners, but it starts at the top. And so you can't, as you said, you can't groom and you can't have people who can make it there if they're churning before, you know, at the middle or they don't even get there. But there's also some urgency for boards to act now. What I tell some of the boards I'm on is when you're looking at, okay, well, bringing on someone diverse, you can't kind of take people out of the game before you start. Things like, you know, we need a woman of color and she has to have been a CEO before. Okay, well, you can stop right then and there, right? So as opposed to what are the core competencies or that we need, et cetera? Who are we serving and how is that reflected in the boardroom? I know we can count time and time again, poor decisions, bad PR campaigns, et cetera, that appear not only offensive, also tone deaf and detrimental because there's this groupthink. And so better decisions at the board level and better accountability will trickle down quickly, quite frankly, because people normally act in their own best self-interest. But also when you think about grooming the next set of leaders and holding on to them. So we approach it from both ways.
Yeah, it's amazing what you guys are doing. What's your vision? What's next? I know for the business, where do you see Landit in expanding potentially? Is it just in terms of growing your customer base, or are there other things that you have a vision for with the business?
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. We started out and, you know, my co-founder, I remember we had a white piece of paper at lunch and she goes, okay, well, who do we want to be? And I was like, well, we want to be Amazon, of course. Of course we do.
I want to own the world.
Right? Well, I say world domination, but when you think about it, who doesn't want to achieve career success? And we don't develop tools for women. We don't develop tools for people of color. We develop tools for success. And so this notion of personalization and portability and best-in-class access and papping someone forward, that's a universal need. And it also solves a universal problem for all organizations globally. So our goal is to be in as many hands as possible because we want to change the landscape of the workplace. And we already see that. So whether that is individuals, whether that is big behemoth companies, whether that's in the nonprofit world, it is how do we scale and continue to scale and go, you know, we're already in 41 countries. How do we continue to grow and do that?
41 countries. Amazing.
Yes, we are. We are. Some things are universal. Chocolate chip cookies, music.
Yes, yes.
And love.
Yes.
And career success.
And sports.
Do you notice the hierarchy there?
Yeah. I see where your mind's at, which
and of
is
course,
where,
sports.
Where my mind's at as well. Trust me, especially after my daughter, who is a 11-year-old baker, baked these incredible cookies last night. And unfortunately, I kept going back to the fridge and like, you know, when you're like, just going to take one, fine, two. Okay, now like all hell's broken loose and you feel awful the next morning. That's where I'm at.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, mentioned sports and as you know, and some of your listeners may know, so husband's deputy commissioner of the NBA, and I look at how they use their platform beyond just sports, right?
Oh yeah.
How you can use the position that you have in the access to create access and change and really momentum in all types of issues. No longer can leaders just be silent and let somebody else kind of take the reins. People have to know where you are. You have to be obvious and visible with your commitment. So people know there is no gray. It's like where do you stand when it comes to these fundamental issues that impact society? So while you're eating chocolate chip cookies, of course.
Well, as a sports fan, I will say the NBA has done such a great job about getting out in front and leading. And, you know, I even think back to when I realized COVID was serious. You had that moment. It was when the NBA canceled their season. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow. Like, I almost believe more in the NBA and what they were doing than the government, right? So I'm like, okay, something's up here now. But they have been great at that. And in the time we have left, I wanted to ask you, how do you envision the workplace now coming back and what's that going to be like? I live in New York City and I know you're local as well. And like you go through Midtown now and you see empty office buildings and I'm in a neighborhood, so you'd never know on the Upper West Side, but you go into Midtown and it's ghost town. Like,
indeed.
How do you envision work returning? Is it a hybrid model? Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts?
I believe it has to be a hybrid model because I think organizations have determined that it's not necessary to be productive and effective for everyone to be there. Some of the best talent will decide, I don't want that anymore. Commuting is awful, whether you have a family or not, personal time or not. And so the ones that are going to win are going to be the ones that think about meeting people where they are, having a culture that is more inclusive, which means you have to be more intentional. I think communication by default has to be better. So because you have to reach people and keep them engaged. And I actually believe more diverse talent is going to come into the workplace because it's not going to be defined by these walls, by location, by what your personal situation is. It will hopefully be more about your skills and your commitment and things of that sort. But I think it's going to be tough. It's going to be rocky. There are some people who I believe are getting it right. And there's a whole bunch in the messy middle that are trying to figure out how to navigate. But now is that inflection point. So I cannot imagine us going back to the way it is. And those that believe, well, you know, our culture means, you know, you have to be co-located. That's not what culture is about. Culture is about norms and rules of engagement and inclusion and rituals and things of that sort. So you're going to have to get creative. We're going to have to get outside the box. But fundamentally, and it was already going that way. If you think about globalization, if you think about just flexing in terms of flex time and things of that sort, people these days and this new crop of youngins, and I have two of them, want to work differently. Yeah. They want to work differently. And I don't think the stigma is there anymore. And I hope that there's a lot more empathy. Because now everyone has been at home with chaos going on in the background and understand what's going on. And so I hope we lead with that and then follow with the other items, you know, closely behind.
Yeah, I think the fact that everyone was kind of forced, at least in corporate America, to really learn and understand video and these, whether it's virtual Zooms or all these technologies, the fact that everyone kind of was forced to have this huge like learning experience, because prior, if you didn't, I could just imagine it would be more years. It seems like it's sped up the fact that now people are much more comfortable with it. So it can lead to kind of this hybrid model. And you mentioned some companies are doing it right. Can you give me an example of what that means, what doing it right is right now?
So I'd say there's a couple of things. One, being very clear about your policies and where you are, because when you're not clear, people make up their own reality, and that's always bad. So being really clear about where you stand, being thoughtful about how do you support people, whether, and again, it's not just about career, but what's the communication? How do you equip them? How do you keep them tied in? So making sure as you're thinking about who's coming in, quote, to the office, maybe there are other ways of working. Maybe it's not one big office. Maybe it is small pods and kind of shared spaces. So I think that's actually going to be an area that people are considering. How do you allow them to convene in that way? And yes, you have to keep retaining and developing your people. And so this notion of bringing everybody together and no. That's not going to happen anymore. One, it wasn't working before, and it's really not going to work now. And so thinking more intentionally about that, changing the way recruiting is done and what that messaging is and how do you onboard someone remotely. So when I think about the companies that I think are doing it right, they're ticking through those things.
Yeah, it's an amazing time. It's super interesting. We were supposed to do this podcast, me and you, probably a year and a half ago. And
we
kept getting pushed back, but I'm glad we did because there was just so much more to talk about. And I just want to say by ending, it seems like Landit and where you are and what's happening with all of these things going on right now in the world, you really are set up to really make even more change in this world. And I wish you the best of luck. I'm sure we'll keep reading about your success and 41 countries blown away. It's amazing what you have created.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your patience. I'm so glad this moment came. And we're excited. We're excited about how we are impacting, we'll continue to impact, and really, really excited to be speaking with you today.
Well, I'm excited. So I look forward to hearing much more from you. And thanks again, Lisa.
Thank you.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost,
and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.